Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is edition 305. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation with Emma Feltz. Emma is a researcher and educator, also a longtime activist to build alliances between social justice activists in Canada and Indigenous communities. I thought that this conversation would be important to have because Emma really zeroes in and talks about some key issues that affect Canada today, namely the realities of this territory being largely unceded Indigenous territories. So we really talk about what does that mean and what does that mean in the context of 2025-2026 when Prime Minister Mark Carney is talking about the massive development of infrastructure projects that impact Indigenous territories, both traditional and treaty-based territories. And I thought it would be important to have an overview conversation with somebody who's done many years of work to both articulate and define these terms and also build relationships with frontline Indigenous communities who are facing these questions on their land directly. This is an important conversation, and I'm really happy to share it with you here on Free City Radio. Today, there's a lot of conversations taking place in Canada about the whole framework of national development, and the elected Liberal government under Mark Carney has been really pushing this idea that there can be this rapid development of a lot of extraction-driven initiatives, whether it's mining or pipelines. Of course, there's been meaningful demonstrations to signify opposition and to voice opposition from Indigenous communities, and that's taking place not only in critique of the federal Liberal plans, but also in Ontario around the Conservative provincial government, and also in Quebec against this sort of similar pattern we're seeing. So Emma, I thought it would be kind of important to have a conversation with somebody who in their research and scholarship and also activism has really addressed this framework of unceded lands. Because that's so central to a lot of these points of conversation. And I feel like often in a lot of discussions around them, particularly in mainstream reporting, there's a lack of definition and also discussion of this sort of basic framework, which is complicated, but I think there's some essential points to communicate. So I wanted to sort of ask you about that. You know, for whoever might be hearing this on a community radio station, you know, I think Emma can provide some interesting insights on this. So maybe you could just first start by introducing yourself and responding a little bit about the importance of understanding this framework in relation to all these conversations about quote unquote development that are happening today.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I'm a white settler scholar and a solidarity activist. For the last about 15 years, I've been working in partnership with Indigenous communities, predominantly in BC, on projects, both scholarly and non-scholarly, public advocacy ones, that assert Indigenous jurisdiction in one way or another over resource projects within constitutional law. And now, in the context of the climate crisis, I'm working more and more on issues of jurisdiction and environmental stewardship. These days, I work predominantly with the Tsilhqot'in National Government in central BC, but I've worked for a long time with Secwepemc peoples and have received incredible mentorship from many others, many Indigenous peoples, especially in British Columbia. I'm also a brand new, as of this July, assistant professor in sociolegal studies in the Center for Criminology and Sociolegal Studies at the University of Toronto. And so, yeah, over all of these years and various projects, my work has kind of circulated around this idea of cession or things being ceded and unceded, and on the idea of dispossession. And so when we say unceded, I mean, in really basic terms, I think what we're saying is something that hasn't been given, something that is unsurrendered or taken without the consent of the peoples whose territory, whose lands it is. So, you know, an international law cession or the process of ceding something is effectively the transfer of property from one entity to another. But we're usually talking about the transfer of land from one state to another through some process of mutual consent. So through agreement, meaning that both of these state parties agree to the transfer and that that transfer is then formalized in some mechanism. And usually we're talking about treaty. And of course, this is also directly connected to sovereignty, because usually when we talk about ceded land, the subtext, or not even the subtext, I mean like the legal and political significance, is that that state acquires sovereignty over that territory that has been ceded to it by another sovereign polity. So there's a mutual understanding of each other's sovereignty, and one cedes land and the sovereignty over it to another. And so you see a real connection between sovereignty and land through this concept of cession or ceding and unceding. And this is especially relevant in Canada, where consent to cede one's land is supposed to be the kind of foundation of our constitutional relationships between the Crown and Indigenous peoples, where, you know, the Royal Proclamation of 1763 said that here in Canada, we could only settle lands with Indigenous consent. So effectively, it had to be agreed by something like treaty, and everything else is dispossession. And so when we use the word unceded here, for example, in a land acknowledgement, oftentimes you'll hear the word unceded come up. We're effectively acknowledging that the land was taken without consent. We didn't do the thing that King George III said in the Royal Proclamation of 1763, said we had to do in order to rightfully claim any land or exercise sovereignty over it. And so when we say unceded, we are acknowledging that through one mechanism or another, it was effectively stolen. I have a sort of issue with that, with something that bugs me, is that you often hear the term unceded in land acknowledgements in British Columbia, where you don't often hear it in the rest of Canada. And I encountered this even recently in moving from, I did my PhD in UBC, where we always use the word unceded in land acknowledgements institutionally. And now coming over to Ontario, I was previously at York and now I'm at U of T. And in neither of those contexts does the official land acknowledgement use the word unceded. And to me, this is a bit of a, like a diss on the treaty territories. So as many people know, apart from a sort of corner in the northeast of the province, which falls under Treaty 8, much of BC is not subject to a historic treaty. The Crown did not sign historic treaties with Indigenous peoples in BC, and so their land is considered unceded. There was no agreement based on mutual consent to cede their lands. But the thing is that in most historic treaty territories across Canada, number treaties and other historic treaties, Indigenous signatories to those treaties also deny that the land was ceded, sold, or surrendered in those treaties. And many understood those agreements to, and the terms that were negotiated orally in those agreements, to be effectively agreements to peaceably share the land and its resources and jurisdiction over it. I'm careful to say, use the word unceded in my land acknowledgements anywhere that I am in Canada. Canada's all Indigenous land, unceded and unsurrendered.
Maybe that's an interesting moment and opportunity, Emma, to talk a bit about treaties, because I think in shorthand, often treaties are talked about in a framework of sort of an understanding that, oh, these treaties have been agreed upon between colonial forces and Indigenous nations. And that means that sort of the questions at hand about Indigenous territorial rights and cultural sovereignty are addressed, where clearly that's not happening. So maybe just a little window into why problematizing and understanding a bit more about the limitations, to use a understated term, around these treaties is important to understand.
Yeah, I'll only speak really briefly about this because this is not the area where I do much work. I have done work in partnership with treaty peoples and have learned a ton from them, but it's certainly not something where I've put a ton of focus. But, you know, when we talk about historic treaties, that can refer to a number of things, including what we call the number treaties, but also peace and friendship treaties. And there are other kinds of treaties that cover parts of Ontario and Quebec and elsewhere that aren't number treaties. And oftentimes, legally, they can be considered lands cession treaties, so specifically agreements to cede land. And so this is why I brought it up in the context of explaining the word unceded. You know, many Indigenous peoples who were signatories to those treaties, but also scholars, have looked at the oral histories, the treaty commissioners' notebooks, and other archival materials that all kind of mutually support that these were not necessarily land cession treaties, and that instead the mutual understanding between treaty commissioners and the Indigenous leadership who were there, as well as witnesses who were there, was that these were agreements to share various resources, to share various parcels of land, and agreements mostly around sort of jurisdiction, who can do what where, with some deference to Indigenous sovereignty and jurisdiction. And so that's why I'm careful when I use the word unceded, wanting to make sure that it doesn't carry with it some subtext that the treaties were cession treaties. In a report from 1981, I think, written by Marie Smallface Marulli that I was just reading this morning, she says that Canada basically, she uses the word, propagandized their version, so the written version of the treaties, which indicate that land was ceded.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts on that, Emma. I really appreciate it. So there's a number of directions we could go, but one of the things I think that could be important to address, you know, for people hearing this, there's been so much discussion about, let's just throw out some terms, reconciliation, sort of a whole discussion and framework of sort of coming to terms with the past. I think one response to a lot of these discussions is some form of acknowledgement, but then a lot of people freeze, especially like if we're talking about like institutions that are doing land acknowledgements. Your work sort of trying to get into the weeds, as it were, with different communities who are really like living these questions on a territorial level, I think is important. You know, there's a lot of interesting people doing this type of work across what is called Canada. Maybe just your thoughts on not freezing, right? And sort of this idea that there's challenges in this work, but that's kind of the point, is getting into it. I think that some of the discourse can sort of just be like, okay, well, non-Indigenous people, back off and, you know, freeze in your privilege, but that's not really going to address much.
Yeah, that's such a good question, and I think a tricky one. I think paralysis is like so common and so easy for those of us who are non-Indigenous, but especially those of us who are white settlers who have some kind of desire to do right by Indigenous peoples and don't know how. And assume that maybe freezing is the way to do right by Indigenous peoples, or otherwise feel kind of lost in this nebulous kind of moment of reconciliation, which doesn't provide actually much political guidance, as much as it might provide a kind of cultural idiom for what we might call good faith discussion, but doesn't actually provide us a ton of guidance about how we make political decisions. And so I mentioned, you know, all of my work, the theme that kind of unifies my work, and I'm greatly influenced by my friend, geographer Shiri Pasternak in this, like all of it has been in some way about the assertion or reassertion of Indigenous jurisdiction. And whether that be, decision-making in their lands over resource extractive projects, environmental management and stewardship and other kinds of decision-making authority. And so I have had the great privilege of kind of being able to practice the very principles that I also research, like be able to figure out how to and be guided by incredible Indigenous mentors in how to abide Indigenous jurisdiction while also researching it, right? And that has really been my sort of like pathway out of that paralysis, is like by listening to Indigenous authorities in the decisions that they're making, and honoring those and respecting those in ways that are really minute in like my research methodology, but then in broader ways in like sort of the political work that I've been doing in alliance with different people. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that, Emma. I really appreciate it. I think, you know, just thinking a little bit about the points you brought up, and also to mention specifically some research efforts that you have been connected to sort of lift up the story of the Constitution Express that was connected to George Manuel and the BC Federation of Indian Chiefs. That's the father of a amazing now Arthur Manuel, who has passed on, scholar and author and activist. To mention this, the fact that there's so little popular knowledge of such an incredible accomplishment that came out of the Constitution Express, and you know, I'd love for you to share a bit about that, illustrates to me, at least on a basic level, how important it is for people to engage with this stuff and try to popularize and communicate these both histories, but also how they're integrally linked to present day.
Yeah, thank you for that prompt, because probably the majority of what I learned about the principle of something being unseated is through the indirectly or directly through the Constitution Express, which was, as you mentioned, a movement that was organized by the Union of BC Indian Chiefs and led by Grand Chief George Manuel, who is the father of Art Manuel, who was a mentor of mine for many years until he passed away, and who got me, who sort of turned me onto the Constitution Express, put a bug in my ear at some point along the line when I was working with him, about this movement that, you know, his dad and all of these incredible people had led in the early 1980s, when Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau was trying to, quote unquote, patriate the Constitution of Canada from the UK, which is often credited with getting Aboriginal rights, Section 35, which recognizes and affirms Aboriginal rights in Canada, added to the patriated Constitution. So there was no rights clause recognizing Indigenous rights in Canada's Constitution before that. And when the Constitution ultimately was patriated in 1982, it had this new clause, Section 35, in it, largely as a result, well, really, not largely, entirely as a result of Indigenous peoples who organized against patriation through the patriation period, including the Constitution Express. So the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, in this incredible move, chartered two trains from Vancouver to Ottawa, which is how it became known, obviously, as the Constitution Express, and brought up to 1,000 people from communities in BC to Ottawa to protest patriation. But it wasn't just the train ride. What I refer to as the Constitution Express was actually a movement that these train rides sort of spawned, that took place over the course of 2 years, where they went not just to Ottawa, but to the UN in New York, and they went and launched a case in London, and lobbied Westminster. And so a really incredible movement that, even though nowadays the narrative is that it was instrumental in getting Section 35 in the Constitution, what I learned once I started talking to people about it, and I had incredible mentorship for people who were involved, I learned that it was a movement against patriation, effectively saying Canada can't patriate the Constitution without our consent. And so this actually relates back to the conversation about ceded and unceded, in that Canada is meant to be founded on the concept of that we have to go and get consent from Indigenous people. That's our foundational constitutional relationship. And so the argument that folks on the Constitution Express and many other Indigenous movements that were organizing at this time were making was that you can't actually go and patriate this Constitution without our consent, and that we need to have a jurisdictional stake in this, some kind of decision-making authority in what a patriated constitution even looks like. And furthermore, that the treaties were never devolved down to Canada. And so what happens to the treaties that were signed with the British Crown, effectively signed with the British Crown when the Constitution is patriated? And so I got to work with some amazing people, including folks like Sharon Venn, the late Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chief, Ron George, and his daughter, Vicky George, who did her own amazing project on the Constitution Express, interviewing those who were involved in it, which mine really builds upon, and got to learn about these legal arguments that they were making around consent, around the sort of incremental but persistent dispossession of Indigenous jurisdiction that really characterizes Canadian colonialism, and how effective they were in arguing for it. In London, they had allied MPs arguing in British Parliament for, instead of a rights clause in the Constitution, a consent clause, where Indigenous peoples would have some kind of sort of jurisdictional oversight over any changes to the Constitution, over decision-making in Canada. That work has been incredibly meaningful and incredibly informative to me in terms of, thinking about movements today that are arguing for Indigenous jurisdiction, including the movements against some of the legislation that you were talking about at the outset, that Carney is trying to push through, which effectively override and circumvent any kind of Indigenous consent or jurisdiction.
Well, maybe we can wrap up on this point, which is, from your perspective, Emma, maybe just connecting these sort of threads and the complexities, whether it's around understanding the more layered reality of treaty territory, the basic framework of unceded land, and also these uprising moments where their Indigenous organizing has played a central role in changing the direction of political policy in Canada, which I think is just a narrative shift that's important to underline. Generally, if you could just talk about why all this is important now, 2025, 2026, with what we're seeing in these contemporary conversations around quote-unquote national development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, really as a it's marketed as a response to Trump and the threat of, not only the economic threat of the tariffs that Trump has imposed globally, but particularly on Canada, but also as a sort of as expression of Canadian sovereignty. We've had Carney has introduced this federal legislation called Bill 5, which includes one of two of pieces of federal legislation under Bill 5 is the Building Canada Act, proposes to fast track certain projects which are deemed to be quote unquote critical infrastructure and quote unquote in the national interest. So fast tracking means bypassing a bunch of existing environmental regulations and normal processes through that projects would normally need to go through to get approval including indigenous consultation and consent. And it's not just federal legislation. We have a bunch of this legislation across different provinces here in Ontario. We also have something called Bill 5. It's two Bill 5s. And in BC, we have Bill 14 and 15. Quebec and Nova Scotia also have their own legislation, each of which is meant to make it easier for developers to, you know, get shovels in the ground, start building these infrastructure projects faster by bypassing environmental regulation and indigenous consultation and consent. And so effectively, you know, we already know that Canada has a pattern of bypassing consent. With this legislation, we've just effectively made it official policy to do so. Not surprisingly, in the draft list of the kinds of projects that we suspect will be approved or proposed under this legislation, we are seeing that it will likely include a new pipeline bringing oil from the tar sands in Alberta to the northwest coast of BC. And as we know, Indigenous peoples in BC have been at the forefront, literally on the front lines, fighting those kinds of pipelines. And what this legislation effectively does is it swaps out consent for what Carney is calling economic participation. So instead of having decision-making authority, they'll effectively get a cut of the deal. And so it does feel like a sort of replay of the kinds of conversations that were being had in the 80s during the patriation of the Constitution, where consent has been pulled off the table and something else, some other kind of compensation prize, some acknowledgement of your rights and some acknowledgement that, yes, you need to have some kind of input and probably get some kind of compensation, is being offered up instead of any kind of real self-determining decision-making authority.
Thanks, Emma, for going over all this. There's a lot of threads to follow in what you've highlighted. The archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio for anybody hearing this on a FM or AM station will link to some of Emma's work. Just search for this interview. Thank you so much for the conversation today, Emma.
Thank you.
That was a conversation with Emma Feltz, who is an educator based at the University of Toronto in Toronto, of course, and also a researcher and activist, speaking about the context and importance of understanding the historical meaning of unceded Indigenous territory in the context of Canada. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. Thank you for tuning in. This program is supported by the Social Justice Center at Concordia University. We air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll speak to you next week.